And we are, as a people, inherently and historically
wake up.
Opposed to secret societies, the secret oaths, and the secret proceedings.
The show that asks questions about why we don't ask questions.
What the hell is going on?
This is Conspiracy Queries with Alan Parr. Welcome to the show. And the show is Conspiracy Queries with Alan Park. And these are Conspiracy Queries, and I am Alan Park. So we've got that out of the way, at least. Okay, we're getting into some nicer temperatures in this part of the world where we broadcast, from where we broadcast here in Toronto, in Canada, which is the 51st state, evidently. According to the oil pipeline companies and the political objectives of whoever really wants to run America, it's pretty much going to go down the same way in Canada. So, 51, we're the 51st state. Might as well just do it. Especially as our leader is a hump. Anyway, we've got a great guest in here today, and his name is Alan Weisbecker. Now, I hope I pronounced that all right, Alan, because when I say Alan, for me, it's got only one L, and Alan Weisbecker has two L's. And Alan Weisbecker is, I could just get real sexy with it right away and say he's a former screenwriter, and he wrote stuff like Crime Story, that show with Dennis Farina, that great actor. And he also wrote Miami Vice. Now, hey, we're dating ourselves here. This is like 30 years ago, and at that time, Alan was, he took his cocaine and marijuana smuggling and hashish smuggling crazy days, and came across some people in the film business and Michael Mann, the director, and next thing you know, he's writing Miami Vice episodes, and that's pretty cool. But his life has changed a lot since there, and he's basically a traveling nomad. He takes a dog and a camper, and he meets people, and he talks to people, and he has a different understanding of how he likes to govern his life and how he likes to interact with people, and it's very different from the, you know, the norm of getting up at 9 to 5 and doing your job in that way and having a few wings and beers with the boys and watching the game. That's not what Alan is all about. And but he does have a very interesting life. I don't know if I could do it myself, but he quite enjoys it. So he'll be on shortly, and that's Alan Weisbecker. In the meantime, let's just understand something here. There seems to be a lot of problem lately. I posted something on Facebook a while ago regarding police brutality, and boy, did that cause a bit of a storm with people who were upset that I would include such a thing on my page. Basically, somebody provokes a cop by driving around all day following him with a camera, and eventually the cop comes up to his window and says, "Hey, what are you doing?" And the guy says, "I don't have to answer that question." And I guess it's kind of what the people call a sort of a bit of a I can't say the word, but it starts with D and ends with ick move on the show. And yeah, I guess it is, but the cop loses it. And I just figure he's not smart enough to have that job. He's not smart enough to handle it. And sometimes that means jump to the taser and do all kinds of things. Now, his partner handles it beautifully. His partner is also a cop. And his partner is the way things should go there. And it's also, at the end of it, the partner realizes that this guy in the video does have the right to do that, be he a D with a ICK following it or not. And that even if he is, he shouldn't be harassed by a crazy man who obviously doesn't have his act together as a cop. But I do point out they've lowered the IQ standards, that's not my problem. I didn't do it. I didn't lower the IQ standards, but I guess it is that a very intelligent person, well, it's kind of difficult for them to want to do the job of being a cop, I guess. Or why would they lower the standards? Maybe I'll talk to someone at a police force to ask about that soon, because it is a curiosity, and I don't understand why people get so offended by the fact that police violence will be posted. And it's okay to say, well, they're just trying to make sure the scumbags don't do anything. But I expect trouble from a scumbag. I don't expect scumbag action from a cop, and I don't appreciate it. And I'm sure there's a family in Toronto who no longer have a kid in their family who was riding a streetcar who was ambushed and killed by a bunch of cops last year. Shot him. No point. It was some 18-year-old kid, you know, sitting there in the streetcar with a knife. Okay, he shouldn't have been doing that, but they didn't need nine guys to kill him. I mean, they're just doing it all wrong. Anywho, We're going to move on now and talk to Alan Weisbecker because he's a nomad. I can't believe I was able to track this guy down for more than 10 minutes to be able to talk with him. But I'm sure you're going to enjoy what he has to say. And hopefully you can, if you're a surfer, I think you'll really enjoy what he has to say. So let's go to our interview. Where are you? You know, but I don't. Where are you right now?
Right. Well, I'm in one of my favorite places in the world, Montauk, New York.
Montauk.
Which is on the very tip of Long Island. And when you think of New York, you have a certain image. But this is much more like New England or even Nova Scotia, sort of. It's a fishing community with water on three sides. And I'm looking at the water right now. It's a really beautiful place. I'm going to be sorry to leave it with you. I'm in the process of getting my act together, as I mentioned to you, to hit the road very soon. And I'm going to be a nomad again.
Now, tell us, everybody, Alan Weisbecker is a nomad, pretty much. I guess that's a great and an actual real-life nomad. It's really cool. I've never done that myself. But tell me, Alan, how did you start doing this? I mean, you know, let's tell some people about your backstory. You were involved with drugs at some point, then you were a screenwriter based on that experience, and now you've decided that basically the way society seems to have put itself together is not really a true story, and you're traveling around trying to show people evidence of that fact, that that story's not true. And now, just before you talk, I have to say you had a lawyer in your film, Water Time, which you want to look at on YouTube, everybody. It's amazing. And this lawyer, if I say, here's some more evidence, I got way more evidence, will you consider it? This guy says, no, I don't. If it counters my preconceived notion, I never want that guy to be my lawyer. Like, how do you deal with this stuff? So basically, how did you get into this in the first place?
Well, it goes back, you know, when I think about how I got to be what I am, whatever that is, I always go back to the winters of 1967 through 70, when I was a college-age kid. And I had seen the film The Endless Summer here in New York, and I also read Jack Kerouac's book On the Road. And I did this with my best friend, Donnie, that I grew up with. He's like my brother. And we decided that the surfing life plus the road life would be the life to lead. So the historical times were against us on a certain level. It was the mid-60s. And he got drafted and ended up going joining the Marines rather than the Army and going to Vietnam. And I went to college in Hawaii. Now, this was – go ahead.
No, I was just thinking, I mean, given the choice to go to Vietnam and fight or go to Hawaii, I think I'm more on your side.
Yeah, I know. And I try to think back as to what kinds of discussions we had about that. And it's really difficult for me to remember, but I know that it was not a small decision on either of our parts, you know. But the thing was, he left and he figured he'd spend 2 years in the Army, and he'd meet me in Hawaii, and we'd be off on our surfing, you know. Somehow, some way, we were kids; nothing could go wrong. And I was going to go to Hawaii and pretend to go to college, which is what I did. I lived on the North Shore, where it's like the Himalayas of surfing. I don't know if you're familiar. If you see all the pictures of huge waves, that's where I lived. I mean, I lived right on the beach at Pipeline, which is one of the most dangerous, biggest waves, fastest waves in the world. And I had surfed enough in New York, and I had a natural ability, thank God, or I would have gotten killed over there. But anyway, this is 67, and the three winters I spent doing that, and you got to remember, this is the 60s. This is like we were a counterculture within a counterculture, the surfers there. We were like hippies with a purpose, you know. We were going places both psychologically with acid and all that.
Acid.
And we were going, you know, LSD.
Sure.
We were going places no one had gone before on waves because it was part of the surf revolution, too, with the shortboards coming in.
Did you ever go surfing on, like, you were on acid and go surfing?
Yes. Oh, yeah, many times.
Oh, wow.
In fact, in one of my memoirs, Captain Zero, I talk about a friend of mine who's actually a legend in the surfing world named Jock Sutherland, who rode Waimea Bay, which is the biggest waves in the world, like 30 to 40-foot waves, in the middle of the night under a full moon with a head full of orange sunshine acid. Now, it's hard for me to be impressed by anybody's feat after knowing Jock. I mean, if you can imagine paddling out there in survival conditions in the middle of the night with a head full of acid, that's the kind of people I hung around with.
Wow.
So the point that I'm getting at is by the time the 60s were over, I thought surfers can do anything.
Yeah.
It sounds like a joke now because of the image we have of surfers, but I really believed that that I was indestructible. So a buddy of mine and I decided to go on the road. This was after Donnie was killed in Vietnam. That's,
yeah.
You know, I have to say that. And that's part of the movie, of course, but I'm giving the backstory of myself.
Sure,
right
yeah,
now.
No, absolutely.
Yeah. So this other buddy of mine and I went to North Africa. We went to Germany, bought a Volkswagen van, and drove down to North Africa, where we found good waves. And we also found we could buy hashish at $40 a pound. And we could sell it in the States for $1,000 a pound.
Sure.
So that sounds really good.
Unless you wind up in a Turkish prison like Billy, what's his name, in Midnight Express. Oh, my God. You don't want to.
Right.
How did you get away with that? Man, oh, man.
But you're forgetting, surfers can do anything. Billy wasn't the surfer.
No, that's true.
Right? So, anyway, my friend ended up coming back to the States, and I ended up staying in North Africa for a couple of years and became a hashish smuggler, and your beautiful country, Canada, was involved in that.
Oh, how so?
Twice. I would ship a Volkswagen van from Amsterdam to whatever, to Canada. City.
Okay. Yeah,
right?
I think I'm living after my time. This sounds wonderful. Okay, so you shipped a Volkswagen van full of hashish from Amsterdam to Canada. Oh,
right. Yeah,
nice.
We'd get it in North Africa and drive up there and then ship it over. And one of the times, instead of driving the van across the border, you'll get a kick out of this. It sort of relates to the war on terror and how difficult it is to get things or people into the country.
Sure.
The way we got it in was I took it out of where it was stashed in the van and put it in a knapsack, and we drove down the road in Canada to the New York border and as soon as we saw the border, my friend stopped the car. I got out and walked around in the woods to the other side where he was waiting. So, I mean, that's how difficult it is to get into the country. But that was my Canadian.
Yeah, that was a long time ago, sure.
Yeah, this is 1971.
Sure, that was before all this fake stuff that, you know, all these fake rules and, you know, shampoo up in an airplane, that's super dangerous. You know, all that.
Right,
so, yeah.
Right, yeah. No, when I think of the idiocy of things like that, when, you know, I was bringing it at one point when I became, you know, like when I rose up in the ranks of smuggling with marijuana, I would bring in 10,000 pounds at a time, you know, and that, I mean, it's not difficult to get things from one country to another. You can trust me.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sort of a space cadet, and I never got caught.
And like a 10,000 pound, like, wow, have you got any left?
No.
Oh, okay, just checking. It sounds like a lot.
I don't know where the money went either.
Okay.
I blew it out the exhaust of my Learjet and spent it on women and good times, although there may be a suitcase full somewhere that I buried that I forgot about. I don't know.
Let's hope.
But, yeah. But anyway, I'm trying to bring us to closer to now. At a certain point in the late 70s, I realized that the smuggling thing was not a lifetime occupation because you end up dead or in jail.
Sure.
And that ended up being true. The people that I knew were all dead or in jail.
Or you could do both. You could go to jail and then get killed there.
And then
know?
Be dead.
Sure.
Dead and in jail.
So you do have a bit of a choice, but yeah.
Yeah. So I had always been bent towards the right. You know, I always wanted to make images and write. And so I called a friend of mine, one guy I knew in the film business who lived, he was a producer in Hollywood, in Bel Air. I mean, almost the cliche of a producer in a mansion and all that. And I happened to know him from my drug days, but it wasn't, you know, like we had a business relationship. And I called him up and I said, listen, I'm getting out of my old business. I want to be in the movie business. What should I do? So he said, write the best screenplay ever written and bring it out here. And then you can get into the business. He was just like bullshitting me, right?
Right.
So I spent a month in the Sherry Netherlands Hotel in New York and wrote a screenplay that I'd been thinking about, you know, and I didn't, you know, I actually knew that I had some talent as a writer because I was a writer when I was a little kid. And then there was this gap where I was surfing and doing crazy things. But anyway, I brought the screenplay out there. It was 1980 and there was an actor's strike, so he wasn't busy. And I knocked on his door, and I can still remember him answering the door and saying, you're here, you're actually here. I handed him the script.
Who is this you're handing? This producer, right?
This is a producer, a TV producer.
Okay.
At the time, he was producing Laverne and Shirley, but he had a lot of other things that he did.
Okay.
That old show. So he sat down by his pool and read my screenplay and wrote me a check there and then and there for an option. It was like the world record for a jerk getting off the plane in Hollywood and getting a deal.
Without prying into your personal private life, and it was a long time ago, do you mind saying how much that was?
How much money it was?
Yeah, just for a lark. I mean, no, it was 30 years ago or whatever, so, you know.
Well, it was an option. It was like $5,000, but the way it works is they pay you $5,000 or $10,000 or $2,000, and then they have the option of producing it, and if they produce it, then it's a lot more money.
Oh, okay, great.
So,
yeah.
So it's not, I mean, it's still, though, it's a big deal to have a producer, you know, write a check. It's hard to get them to actually move their hands over
sure.
a check.
Yeah.
Believe me. So the one thing led to another, and I don't know if you know who Michael Mann is. You ever hear
sure,
of him?
Absolutely. The director, he did Manhunter and Miami Vice.
Last of the Mohicans.
Sure, yeah.
And one of our best writer-directors. But anyway, he got a hold of the script, and he loved it. This was the next script he was going to do. That didn't happen, but because of my relationship with him, everybody in Hollywood ended up reading my script, which was a real, it was like Dr. Strangelove combined with Blow, all right?
Okay.
If you can imagine that.
I'd love to read it.
I'd have to look around. It's in the inner recesses somewhere. But Michael, of course, went on to do a lot of things. And soon thereafter, he calls me up and says, hey, I have this new show called Miami Vice. Do you want to be a writer on it? And I said, no, that sounds dumb, Michael. Miami Vice, what does that mean? And so, you know, I didn't hear from him about a month. He called me again and said, listen, come down to Miami. I need a script rewritten on the set. You know, we got script problems.
Mm-hmm.
I'll send all the money you want, whatever. So I went down to Miami, and it was before the pilot came out. So I didn't know anything about the show except that I had a great time down there with the people that make Miami Vice. And you can imagine, you know, it's the 1980s.
Miami, that's where they shot it, right? Not one of these fake Hollywood things.
Right.
And you were having fun down there. Now, tell us a little bit about some of the fun you could have as a writer and involved at the upper tier level of a show that was the juggernaut of the 80s, Miami Vice.
Yeah, that's true. It was. And, you know, I was really on the ground floor, involved in most of the scripts in the first season. But that week I spent writing the scripts as they were shooting it, which is very, very unusual for television. Usually the writers don't even go near the actors, et cetera. But I got to know everybody. I mean, an anecdote, sitting in the hotel bar next to a guy, and we start talking, yeah, I'm on the show too. What do you do? And he says he's an actor. And we had a few drinks together. Ended up, like, dawn, we stagger in after a night on the town, and it was Bruce Willis before he was famous.
Oh, so he still had hair then?
Oh yeah, he had hair then.
Oh,
and
cool.
It was pre-stardom days, but he was a great guy then. I think he probably still is.
Yeah, he comes off as one. I think so, but I don't know the guy. But he seems all right for a right-wing Republican. But you know what I mean?
Is he?
yeah, he is.
Right,
yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, him and Arnold and those guys for sure. Yeah. So I got to separate that from, you know.
That's a disappointment. I mean,
I
remember is we had fun that night.
Sure, I'll bet.
So. Anyway, you know, my career, here's the negative, though, and it didn't lead us up to what we really should be talking about.
Well, sure.
Hollywood, you know, I was making a lot of money. I was making, you know, I'd get paid $75,000 to write a script, and it would take me 5 or 6 weeks. And this is back when, you know, money meant something.
Right.
And, we're going into the 90s now, and I look back at what I had written. I'd written a book in the meantime that I'm very proud of called Cosmic Bandidos, which is a lunatic take on my smuggling days. I knew I had to write about, I mean, I did, I wrote about my smuggling days in Miami Vice only indirectly, but I wrote a book about those days called Cosmic Bandidos, and
yeah.
it turned into a cult kind of phenom.
I'm sure, especially if you were dipping into stories about taking acid and going surfing and smuggling stuff out of Turkey and Afghanistan or whatever. Oh, my God, wherever you were. That's crazy.
Well, it was more, it was philosophical in a really goofy sense. I combined pot smuggling and my website, Bandido Books, is based on the Bandido concept. Just the idea of banditos used to crack me up, like the old movies.
Sure.
We don't need no stinking badges, those
That's
guys.
Right. Yeah.
So one of my main characters was a bandito named Jose, who along with this, like, Indiana Jones kind of wild man who was based on me, get obsessed with quantum physics.
Oh, nice.
Now,
okay.
Now, that's coming out of left field, right? But it turned out, it's very strange. I wrote this book in like 6 weeks, and that's not normal. And it just came right out,
yeah.
And everything made sense. In other words, it was like somewhere deep, I knew everything that was going to happen before I wrote it. It's really hard to explain, but it was a strange, a very interesting writing experience. So my point being, that was the only thing I was really proud of that right. I had done in like 10 years of working in Hollywood.
Sure, but you made a bit of money and you were having fun doing a little surfing on the side and et cetera, but the weight of it all just was like, hey, this isn't good enough for me. Is that basically it?
Yeah, I mean, you know,
like I'm not doing enough.
Well, okay, what's the meaning of life kind of crap?
Right.
What am I doing here with these Hollywood? I've become a Hollywood asshole was what I realized.
And that was even before earpieces in your head and all that stuff.
It was, yes, it that's right. Come to think of it, I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah.
But but I ended up just in 1995, I said, and, you know, I've done this three times since then, so it's starting to be a pattern. I just said, okay, I'm going to change my life. And I had done that going from smuggling to being a writer, and I said, I'm going to do it again. So I gave up Hollywood. And I sold my house here in Montauk. I had a house here. I was living here. And I bought a big pickup truck and put a camper on it and got my dog and my surfboards. And I got rid of everything I didn't need and hit the road with the vague notion that I would look up an old buddy of mine that had disappeared in Central America in 1992.
Mm-hmm.
His nickname was Captain Zero. So the book that I ended up writing is called In Search of Captain Zero. And I spent a year and a half between Montauk and Panama just, you know, traveling, surfing, and looking for my friend. And at the time, I didn't think I would end up writing a book about it, but it evolved to the point where I realized that I had done some interesting things. And the next thing I knew, I found him. At the end of, I mean, it was perfect. Reality became dramatic. I found my friend at literally the end of the road at the bottom of Central America. You cannot go any further south because you hit the Darien Peninsula, which is roadless. And I found him down there a wreck, you know, strung out on crack, et cetera, and hadn't surfed in 6 months or whatever. Hmm. And so that was what I wrote the book about. So, you know, that was my first road trip. And things went well. I come back, write a book. Sean Penn in the studio bought it for the movies. This time I can tell you that the money was serious. It was up there in six figures. So the point here that I guess I'm trying to get at with bringing up money is I didn't write the book for money. I didn't make the film that you just saw for money. I don't believe in doing creative things for money, but if you do good work, the money will come.
You get a bounce out of it. Yeah, something comes when you're putting yourself into a positive application, and you find that works out for you, right?
Yeah, you do. Yeah. But if you're trying to like find an audience, if you're trying to write for other people, it's
right.
not going to work out.
No, exactly. You got to do what you want to do, and then hope they show up for you, right? That's where you're coming from.
Yeah. I don't even hope that. It just happens that way. But you're, I guess, psycho, yeah.
Well, as opposed to going out and saying, okay, I want to make a lot of money doing this, as instead of saying, I want to do this, and if it makes a lot of money, cool, I like that. Like, I find this a lot with kids, younger kids today. They just want to be famous. They don't even care what they're going to do. They don't want to be drummers or singers or this, you know, whatever. As long
right.
as they can be famous. They put up YouTube channels, and they're just trying to be famous, and it's like, Famous should just be a side effect and a byproduct of whatever you got going on that you're successful with, not just because then it's so empty, you know. And I'm so sad that so many youngsters seem to have that going on for them, where they're just trying to be famous for the sake of it.
Famous for being famous.
Yeah, like the Gabor sisters back in the 60s and
right.
the Kardashians and this kind of thing. That's basically
right.
their. That was like an anomaly back then. Anybody else had something behind them, and now it's like everybody, you know, so many kids, they just want to be – anyway, I'm going down that road too many times, but you know what I mean. So, listen, you got to this point where you've been traveling around. You've created this wonderful movie called Water Time, Surf Travel, Diary of a Madman. And it goes through now on this particular film, as you're traveling around with your dog and your other dogs, and it's wonderful the way it's put together, and you've come across some video that you've obtained regarding disasters, let's say, that hit America, and then you show people different angles of things and
right.
things that took place, and this is what is a lot of what's going on with Water Time, and then you're trying to get people to say, hey, this is new information, what do you think of this? And most of them seem to just, you know, ignore it. They just can't believe it. Now, how is that for you to show them this stuff? And what is it that you're expecting them to do to turn around and go, oh, I was completely wrong that time?
Well, that's a good question. The thing is that the film evolved on its own in a sense. What I went on this trip, you know, this was like another time where I got rid of everything and hit the road with a camper and my dog, okay? The first one was In Search of Captain Zero. I had sort of a goal. I was looking for my old friend that disappeared in Central America. This time, I hit the road with just Honey, the dog you see in the film, and the quest that I decided to go on was based on the fact of my old friend, my best friend from childhood, who had died in Vietnam, and we were supposed to do this shit together.
Yeah.
And he was dead, and I was not. And I said to myself, I want to know why that is. And that's when I started looking into history. And, I had a lot of evidence on my laptop, yes, but the reason I had that stuff was I needed to find out what was the cause of my friend's death. And you know, when
sure.
I argue with the lawyer, you start to realize the twisted view of history that people have and why they have it. Because it was very clear to me after really looking into it, and you had to really look into it to find out that John F. Kennedy was the last real president the United States has ever had. He was a remarkable man, and he did change when he was in office. And I'm as cynical as the next guy, with politicians. I saw Obama coming a mile away.
Sure.
I immediately said, I don't know who this guy is, but he ain't who they're telling us he is.
Yeah. Who do you figure he is? I mean, you know, is it a birth thing? Is he born in Kenya or, you know, whatever, Hawaii, the birth certificate, all that nonsense? Does that even matter?
I don't care about that stuff. All I know is he was set up to do this a long time ago, and he is being completely controlled by outside forces, and there is just no doubt about that. He is not who he's. You don't come out of nowhere like that. Unless it's part of the plan.
Sure.
You know, but what I'm getting at, though, is Kennedy was different. Kennedy, and we haven't had a president that was not, and I'm sure it's true with you guys also, in terms of your government. Things don't happen by accident.
No. We somehow wound up, it's been arranged that we've got this corpulent, rude kind of a blowfish in there, and he's got some wife that's shacked up with an RCMP officer, et cetera. This is the story anyway. And this guy he's just following a globalist agenda. I mean, it's painful to watch, you know, but it's been happening, and he's rolling in, and somehow or other there's no opposition to it, and on it goes. Now, listen, you put this film clip together. You put some film clips together, and I was really hoping, like, I know you're showing people things about Kennedy and they can't believe it, and what you didn't have in your film, and I was wondering if you found out since, and you've done a lot of research, was that you know that the American government itself, the most recent conclusion they have regarding the JFK assassination was that it was indeed a conspiracy. They came up with this in 1978, and then subsequently, though, that was the official government version. Yes, there's a conspiracy, but we don't have enough information and time to figure out exactly what it was, etc. And I mean, that's just so pathetic, because people like George Bush Sr., who apparently was in Dallas on the day, have said things like, well, you know, some people actually believe that you know, it wasn't just Oswald that killed Kennedy. Isn't that so funny? And it's like their official position that they left was, yeah, there was a conspiracy. We're not going to get into it, but there was. And then you got these politicians saying, oh, there wasn't any conspiracy. And people swallow it. And I don't know how you go out there. Like, I got a radio show and I'm talking to people, but I don't know how you go one-on-one and go, look at this video. It blows away everything that you preconceived. And then they're like, no, I don't want to believe that. I don't know how you subject yourself to that kind of torture.
On a certain level, it was interesting because my curiosity is really how the world works and why people believe what they believe. So, yeah, it was frustrating on certain levels, but it's also very explanatory as to why things are the way they are. It's not, we have to expect that we're going to have psychopaths at the top, you know, of the pyramid running the world. That's to be expected. That because people that want power are generally, when I say psychopaths or sociopaths, I just mean that the truth means nothing to them, and morality means nothing to them.
Oh, absolutely.
And you don't get to the top unless you feel that way.
But the worst part is they say they're preaching the truth in reality, and they're not. They're bending the rules and bending the truth and making us suffer and pay for it. So thanks for coming on today. I really appreciate it.
Sure.
Hopefully we'll get an update from you. You're going to be coming through Canada. Now, are you going to be bringing some information with you in the way of video or any of these other kind of documents you've managed to get a hold of and show some Canadian people this kind of stuff? Like, is your movie continuing to happen as you roll through your life?
I am going to do that. What I've done is I've given up house and home again. I have a new dog. My dear dog, Honey, in the movie, died last summer, and I got a new dog that is turning out to be a winner. And I'm giving up where I'm living. I'm storing whatever I don't need. And I bought an RV. This is a bigger one. You know, I'm getting older, so I need a little more comfort.
Sure you do.
And I'm hitting the road with no plans to return again. And I'm going to do a more real-time chronicle of my journey via a blog, and since I've gotten into filmmaking, I'm going to combine filmmaking. You know, you can embed YouTube in your blog.
Ooh,
and
that sounds painful.
You know what I mean? I've found my favorite way of expressing myself these days is to combine filmmaking with an essay. In other words, an essay that, you know, you're a few paragraphs down, and there'll be a short film there that will disprove what I'm saying or elaborate on it or whatever. If you go to my website, banditobooks.com, you can see, by the way, the first 7 minutes of Water Time and decide if you want to watch the rest of it or not. And the rest of it's free. I'm not charging for it.
I know, it's on YouTube. I know, that's amazing after all this time.
Right, and here's one problem, though, I'm really sort of bummed out is because, you know, I'm coming up to Canada, and I like Canadians. In fact, the people in the film that you see that are not only the nicest and, you know, the few not mentally, you know, not in denial people I met happen to have been Canadians and one French girl. So I'm sort of a little bummed out that the film is blocked in certain parts
of
Canada.
I tried to watch it here on YouTube, and I couldn't get into it. Now, I found a different way to get in, but the thing you sent me was not operable.
Yeah, that's because of certain movie, certain music clips that I use.
Oh, I see.
And it's a fair use thing, and it's not right. I mean, I won't go into the whole reason why they shouldn't be blocking it, but that's the reason. Now, if any of your viewers or listeners, rather, watch the trailer and want to see the rest of it, I will send them a DVD with no money. I'll put an envelope in there, and you know, you send me back my expenses, which is $5.
Right.
You know,
just to cover the mailing,
DVD
pretty much.
And send it.
Yeah.
I'll put an envelope in the mailer and just send me a five. A Canadian five is fine since I'm coming up.
Yeah, you're coming up here anyway.
You know, I can send it up.
Now, listen, here's what I'm going to do about that. I will embed the link that I did find that I was able to watch the whole thing. So I'll put that on the page when this show goes up for you. And then
How did you do that?
I don't know. I mean, I was sitting there with my kids, man. I mean, one of them's 11. She knows everything. I don't know how to hook that stuff up.
That's great.
Oh, damn, this clip won't work. She's like, give me a minute. So that's how they are.
Isn't that great?
It is great.
Kids are like that?
I remember being like that.
Tell the story of your daughters that they got it. It made me happy.
They immediately started asking me questions about, like, they had a problem with, and that's why I brought it up at the front of the show. They had a problem with this guy who, your lawyer friend, who he's trying to be polite and he's trying to be nice, but basically you're saying in the movie, look, if I can show you all this stuff and I have it and I can bring it to you and there's more evidence that completely belies your belief in the official story, will you just look at it and understand? He's like, no, I'm not interested. I don't even want to know that stuff. And I just don't like the fact that, yeah, as you say, psychopaths seem to gravitate to wanting power and running the world, and then it's people like that underneath that let them get away with it.
Exactly. That's what I was going to say before. Is it's not the fact that the world is run by psychopaths. That's not actually the problem.
You can expect
the problem
that.
Is the people that don't even see what's going on.
Right.
And you see in the film, the one thing the film does it, you know, that I haven't seen in another film, is it shows denial in action in a way that, you know,
it's painful.
People that are awake like you and most, I think probably most of your listeners are awake, they're going to see things.
Well, not all of them.
say again?
Not all of them. I mean, I get some notices from people here and there that are very critical of what I have to say and do, and that's totally fine. But I hear you. People are listening, and that's the best thing.
No, good. Because if everybody agrees what you're saying, then you're doing something wrong.
Yeah, exactly. You can't have that.
Today, I finally got a negative email about Water Time. In the last 2 weeks, I've gotten like 300 emails, and some of them almost brought tears to my eyes because, you know, I worked 6 years in this film, and it really meant something to a lot of people. But today I got a guy who said, you're just a confused old hippie.
Right.
You know? And I shot him back an email saying, thank God I got a negative. If I don't get any negative reviews, I must be doing something wrong.
Well, I don't know if there really is a problem with what an actual hippie is. I don't even know if you are one. But even if you are, I don't think that's an actual problem. And I certainly don't think, you know, compared to old, what is that supposed to mean? You know,
I don't care about that.
You've seen a lot of stuff.
You know, I went to college in the 60s. I must be old.
Yeah.
But that doesn't bother me.
No, of course not.
I am confused. So he's right about everything. But he, what he doesn't understand is he's really confused.
Yeah, I don't...
And he doesn't know it.
What I'm confused about is how a guy like that can swallow this kind of stuff, you know? Like, this official story. Now, you were showing stuff about Building 7, the collapse there of it on the WTC site and on all of that thing to people.
Right.
And they were... some people were open to the changes and wondering why they hadn't seen Building 7 collapse into its own footprint just under 10 seconds and why that's okay.
That clip was Dutch people. It's really, that's the way it worked out. I didn't edit the film in a way to be misleading. Everybody, literally, everybody that was, quote, reasonable, unquote, in other words, could understand critical thinking. That's the way I phrase it. It's all about critical thinking, being able to, see, you know, when you see something that's impossible, for example,
yeah.
And that's part of the explanation of the government, you know they're lying, don't you?
Yeah,
right?
I don't know why
they're lying, and you can really understand history.
So you're saying that
if you look at it like that,
in the manipulation of a situation like 9/11, that was the door opening, so we could go, and I say we, the Western countries, go and invade Iraq, and this is, and then people died over there, citizens unnecessarily, and soldiers apparently, Americans unnecessarily, and you're saying in your movie that because this same lie of a machine guided America into invading yet again another foreign country that had no business being invaded in Vietnam, that your friend went into that. He was sucked in on a ruse. In other words, he was lured in by a lie, basically. And he's like, yeah, sure, I'll go defend my country. And then he didn't make it back. And this happens all the time. So you blame the artifice that was involved in creating the going to war, which is, by the way, now on the record, this whole Gulf of Tonkin incident and all that nonsense.
That's right.
So,
it's been on the record for a while.
So if it's a lie that we needed to go into Iraq, then it's a tragedy and a personal attack on the man and his family who dies there. And you're trying to tell this to this guy, and he's going, well, no, I think he was killed by a bullet. He was killed by enemy fire.
I know.
That's who you got to blame. I was like, are you so stupid? I mean, I can't believe it. He looks like a reasonable guy. He's not having trouble getting his sentences out, but my goodness, he is brainwashed, that fella.
Yes, and he's not the only one. You know, no. I don't have that many friends anymore.
I know. Most of them are called, voters, usually.
Well, you know what I mean. Most of the people I've lived in this town for most of my life, and there's a certain group of people, certain percentage of my old friends that, you know, I sort of came out of the truth closet about 12 years ago when I started realizing the extent that we're being lied to.
Right.
And since then, gradually, the people that are like the people in the movie that I mostly interviewed in Mexico, but they're people here that are like really good friends of mine that don't speak to me anymore because I believe in the laws of physics, for example.
Exactly.
You don't want to believe in the laws of physics and listen to what the government says, because it doesn't work out.
Well, the people believe the leader that said the other story, and the leader often is usually shown going to a church or whatever, a place of worship, and then they go, there's that subliminal connection with like, oh, okay, George Bush is going to church, and he's all upset about this war, and he's going to pray this weekend, so this is all on the money, this is all on the up and up, and it isn't.
Well, it's so not on the up and up that it's in another realm. And I'm just starting, even in the last couple of years, and put it this way, I can't seem to find the bottom of the rabbit hole.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
No matter how deep it seems to go, there's something else that tells me, that I've only, got to the surface of it. And 9/11 is a great example. I mean, first of all, let me just put on the record, the modern history turning point, and this is based on research, and I can argue it, but I just know it, was the assassination of Kennedy. When they did that, and they got away with it because of the media, they realized what they could do, the National Security State, not just the CIA, But this cabal of people, call them the shadow government, whatever you want, they murdered him. And
you figured that was the turn.
That was when they knew that they would get everything they wanted, and the American people would swallow anything.
Okay, now you
all you have to do is repeat it enough times, and they swallow it. I show it in the film in a way you can't argue with. If you're you can't sit down and watch my film with a person
open mind.
That doesn't believe it. They won't sit there. They'll leave before, you know what I mean?
But listen, because Alan, I got to add something here. Now, you did say this again just now, and you said it in the movie, and I'm going to offer a little bit of a counter here to what you've told. Now, you'll understand this totally. So you said in the movie that the turning point of the criminal cabal that's pushing us forward into this nonsense is the folks that killed Kennedy, and I disagree with that, and here's why. I think the cabal, the folks involved that were going to do that, obviously were there and up and running for a long time now. Obviously, Kennedy, that's not the only reason they killed him. I mean, he wanted to do different money, and he wanted to get smash the CIA to without. There's so many people that have a motive. Now, I still don't think that was it. How about going back almost 60 years earlier? Yeah, with the bank and the Plum Island or whatever it's called where they sat there. What was that thing?
Jekyll Island,
right. And they rewrote the whole banking rules and try to make it seem and fool people to think, hey, the bankers really are going to hate this new law. And so people were okay with that and they voted it in.
Right.
But then the bankers wrote it and they were fine with it. So I think this malevolence that you're talking about, maybe it picked up a big time with a wind under the wings in the Kennedy assassination. But man, man, I think this has been going on for a long time.
Well, no, I completely agree with you. I'm saying that, you know, like the modern, put it this way, the assassination of Kennedy was more of a turning point than most people think.
Sure.
Let me put it that way instead of saying it was the turning point. Because really, the big change came at the end of World War II with the formation of the National Security State, the formation of the CIA, and the National Security Act, which basically gave them carte blanche to do anything, and if they call it national security, you can't even look into it. The Kennedy assassination was their first big move after World War II. But World War II was the other turning point when the United States became the world superpower, and it needed a nemesis, which they formed, you know, the Soviet Union and Hitler, by the way, were both backed by Wall Street.
Sure, and they had to do that. They had to back it. They had to get that machine going and get everything built up and all of that kind of stuff. And, you know, this kind of thing has been going on forever. But, Alan, listen, we really have to hang up on you now. I hate to do this. But the show's over, pretty much. And I am looking forward to you coming up here, and hopefully we're going to spend some time together. And maybe we'll record a little segment for the show. That would be so great.
So I'd do, at the very end, a little plug about BanditoBooks.com.
Absolutely. Go ahead. This is the end. Give the plug.
Okay. Please go to Bandito Books, Bandito with a T, BanditoBooks.com. Look at the trailer to my film. That's all I ask, and you can see it for free.
Oh, and by the way, everybody, if you don't have an open mind, don't bother. Everybody else, jump on it. It's amazing.
If they don't have an open mind, it'll annoy them. Good.
Yeah. Okay, well, listen, thanks, Alan. I really appreciate it. We'll talk to you soon.
You got it, Alan.
Thanks for listening to Conspiracy Queries with Alan Park. Please offer comments or complaints by emailing conspiracyqueries@gmail.com or on Twitter @con_queries or at our website, conspiracyqueries.com. Thanks for listening.